You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
I'm not letting this go while it's still fresh. I'm not letting this go. I'm not going to have you sit opposite me and say that you didn't say something that I said you say. I have just reviewed last week's tape about you. Don't tap the table with that. Tape of last week when you said, which you said you didn't say, that you were going to ask Hawthorn for compensation for injuries that you had received during your football career. I said, you said that, and you said, no, I never said that. We have just, and Rocket Rod, did he say that or not? He say that or not?
Yep.
Right, thank you, he did. Don't stop tapping the table. Now, moving on, we've got not a special guest, they're all special, but we've got a man who his craft was riding motorbikes. And if you want a better example of motorsport today, the preeminent motorsport in the world today is probably MotoGP, and then probably superbikes, and then the rest, all the other cars, the F1s, the NASCAR and IndyCar, all follow. If you want to see people with big gonads ride bikes and do it properly, this man excelled when he did it, and he now runs a very successful motorbike enterprise, and his name is Mick Hone, and Mick Hone Motorcycle. So welcome, Mick, to You Cannot Be Serious.
Thank you, Sam.
Now, Mick, when you, because this is what we try and do, we try and get across most of the people's CVs when we ask them to come on. There is an amazing, there's not a lot of information about your great career riding motorbikes. I want you to tell us, seeing as you can be our Wikipedia. You started, I think, in 1969 when you were a child riding Yamaha 125 bikes. That's what it tells us. And after that, you got into riding competitively. What is your CV as far as riding bikes go?
Well, I did start in 69. I was still at high school. And I love motorbikes. My dad rode a bike. My brother rode bikes. So it was in the family. And I just progressed each year, a bigger and faster bike, and eventually rode 500 Grand Prix bikes and super bikes, but, you know,
500 the 500 ones that are now the preeminent motorbike sport?
Well, in those days, they were 500 two-strokes, and I was lucky enough to buy one and raced it, had a lot of fun, got to see, always following really good riders because I could see them in the distance.
Yes. I think you're being self-deprecating,
yeah,
Mick.
Yes, Mick, yes.
But go ahead.
Well, I did have some success, but certainly not, you know, like Mick Doohan or Wayne Gardner success. But, I really loved racing a motorbike. I've never done anything that's as exciting.
I wouldn't wonder.
I mean, some people say, you know, those guys have got death wishes, but that's not what I've ever seen. Most guys have practiced and grown and developed, and they're using skill.
But it is extraordinary, Mick, and Don and I are probably not across this as well, not as we should be. We're just not across it. But I've got intrigued as to, I watch the MotoGP religiously. I think it's a fantastic franchise, and the pure racing, the MotoGP. To have people come down on two wheels in a straight and reach speeds of 230 miles an hour. It just is beyond comprehension how you can say that that is not death-defying.
Well, at that speed, that it's all relative. Those guys go that fast a lot, and they're used to it. And each when you're on the bikes, they're all doing the same speed.
So, and your point, Mick?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't seem like you're going that fast.
No, but, mate, you've only just got to – something's got to happen. You've got to come off. Like Morbidelli did the other day – and that bike went across in front of Valentino Rossi by a hair's breadth, would have just taken his head off. You live with that almost every day, don't you? Every race.
No, I've never seen anything like that before. I mean, I watched it, and you know what happened. Things like similar, but not as dramatic, and that was captured on so many different angles and analysed. But
he came off the bike at nearly 200 miles an hour, didn't he, or not?
Yeah, two of them did.
Falling off a bike at 200 miles, it's extraordinary. No one can comprehend that, Mick.
It's probably safer than crashing an aeroplane, but, you know.
Well, I'll take that on advisement.
People don't stop flying because they crash. I mean, you know, that the guys pit their skill, and what happened was an accident, and what happened afterwards was an incredible, lucky escape.
Mick, you said skill. What about gonads? Now, where does that come into the sport? There's a lot of sports that require a little bit of daring and you're really on the edge. And sometimes people reach that and they can't go any further. Some jockeys are held back. They have it early. I'm talking about guts. You're talking about skill, but there's got to be a lot of guts in it. And do riders reach a point where they say no more and they just don't take that gap, or they won't push themselves a little bit further?
I don't know that you'd ever get that far if you weren't committed.
Yeah, but guts, mate.
I mean, you could play under 12s and not necessarily make the AFL. So there's a lot of guys ride bikes and never, you know, they do it and then stop. But guys that are good at it, the potential to earn a lot of money is pretty good.
The fear factor comes in at different levels, though, doesn't it? Do you recognise that? I don't see
the fear factor. I see that they've got the skill. I mean, those guys are different to normal people. They're not. They're like anybody that's extremely skilled at any sport or talent, whether it's music or football or painting. I mean, they've got a talent. Yes. And mere mortals, I mean, I can appreciate it because I've tried it and haven't been able to do it as well. But mere mortals can't do what they do.
No, because
not balls. Mick, it's,
they have
skill.
No fear. You could not possibly convince me, Mick. I know you're trying to, and we will end up bowing to you because you're the expert. You could not possibly convince me that they just don't have a fear factor like any. You just said they're not normal like any other person. It is extraordinary. They're comparable to big wave surf riders who ride 100-foot waves, which probably put that in the class of MotoGP riders. Mick.
I think they've got respect.
Respect
for their own mortality. It's not like I'm going to do this or I'm going to die. It's not one of those things. When you've got the skill, they can do things. I mean, I watched Casey Stoner do stuff.
Yes.
I've watched Mick do. I mean, you know, we've been very lucky in Australia that we have
Kevin McGee.
Many more successful motorbike races than we should at all levels. And, you know,
because of the population, you mean?
Well, we've only got, you know, 20 million and we bat way above our rate. I mean, last week in Austria, there's two Australians racing in the GP. Both of them finished on the podium. Like
Jack Miller?
Jack Miller was on the podium and Remy Gardner finished on the
podium. Why is that? Why are Australians good at it? Is it the fact that they do a lot of sport or bikes are available when they're younger and they progress that way?
Pretty well. I see it that in Australia, we've got people that are participants rather than spectators. If you want to do something, you can do it in Australia. And motorbike riders have got a whole lot of tracks. In some countries, they have one track and you can't ride on it. Whereas in Australia, when I was growing up, there was, you know, half a dozen tracks in Victoria. You could go and practice. You could do this. If you wanted to do something, you could do it.
So I presume Remy Gardner is Wayne Gardner's son?
Yeah, Wayne's son, yeah.
So there's Wayne Gardner, Kevin McGee, Mick Hone, Casey Stoner.
Mick Doohan.
They're just world-class bike riders in their day.
Well, we've had them since the 50s, since they started Grand Prix. We had our first world champion in the 50s and we've had a succession of them since. So, you know, been really motorbike races out of Australia have been successful.
So what is the difference? I think probably the marquee bike race is MotoGP 500. What is the difference between a 500cc motorbike and a superbike?
Well, it used to be 500. It's now 1 litre. They've gone from two strokes to four strokes. since they went MotoGP.
It's 1,000cc, is it?
Yeah, 1,000cc.
That MotoGP is now 1,000cc.
Yep.
So it's incorrectly termed, is it?
Well, it used to be 500GP when they all rode two-stroke 500s.
Yes.
And then probably 10 years ago they said we're going four-stroke because the two-strokes aren't relevant in the market anymore. Yep. They're not compliant with any emissions and things. So they went four-stroke and they've just gone faster and faster since.
So I mean, a 500 MotoGP bike is actually 1,000 cc's.
Yes.
Well, that's misleading.
It's not 500.
It's no longer called 500.
Isn't it? Oh, I stand corrected, yep. Mick.
So Mick Doohan started on, and Kevin McGee and all those guys are on 500...
cc's?
Yeah, 500 yep. cc two-strokes.
Half a litre?
Yep. And now in MotoGP, since they've called it MotoGP, it's become 1,000.
And what are the superbikes now? They're bigger again?
They're 1,000cc.
So they're the same?
Yeah.
So it's the next tier down, I presume, is it? It's not much money in it? Or why do we have two parallel bikes?
It's the VFA.
I get you.
So on the way up, you might race superbikes, and then if you are talented, you could get an opportunity. A lot of Australian guys have gone from Superbike into MotoGP. Troy Bayliss, Troy Corsa, there's quite a few have gone, had a chance in MotoGP. And then if they succeed, they stay there. If they're not, they go back. And some guys on the way back from MotoGP go to World Superbikes because it's the next level down and they can still be competitive as they get a bit older.
A bit like Formula One and IndyCar.
Yeah, or you know any of that stuff, yeah.
So I presume, Don, I presume the success of the bike brand, your Suzuki, absolutely Mr. Suzuki. Have you met Mr. Suzuki?
No, Mr. O Suzuki's probably, you know, 90.
Gone, is he?
He's 90 or something now, so he doesn't come to Australia.
Why did you go for Suzuki at the time? And how long ago did you start your association with them?
Well, I opened my shop in November 79.
And I remember it down the bottom of Albert Park down – not Albert Park, Mont Albert, Whitehorse Road.
Yeah, we used to call it Box Hill because nobody knew where Mont Albert was in those days. But I was racing Suzukis and I had a natural association with them. And
why did you pick Suzuki to race?
It was a good bike. I mean, they were all probably pretty good bikes, but I just seemed to like the Suzukis and got on with them. And there was an opportunity to open a Suzuki shop. And, you know, we had great success in the last 40 years.
We called it Mont Albert after no one knew where Box Hill was. It's just the perception of it being better. It's like the bloke who lived at Goat Hill and then he renamed it Angora Heights just because it sounded better. Well, now, Mick.
Yes.
Now, Mick.
Yes, Sam.
So the success, this is not revolutionary, this statement, but the success of the bikes obviously translates into market sales around the world. There's a hell of a lot of bikes sold on a yearly basis around the world, millions of them. There's Moto Guzzi, Aprilia, Honda, Ducati. Is KTM and Kawasaki the same? Or no. What's KTM?
KTM's an Austrian brand and they're going very well.
And Yamaha?
Yes.
So the fierce competition is for market recognition, isn't it? Obviously,
it's like
cars like NASCAR or anything.
Yes.
And which is the most popular bike? Mark Marquez rides a
Honda.
Yes.
Honda's traditionally been the number one.
Has it?
In the world. Some countries, for some reason, might have a brand that's more popular, but generally Honda is the biggest. Yamaha was next. Suzuki, Kawasaki.
All Japanese.
Yep.
Why is that?
Yeah.
They make good products.
Did they copy European initially?
They certainly did. Yeah. A lot of things in Japan, they copied and just made it better. They got really good quality control. But, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, Harley Davidson's always been a player. But, you know, Triumph's come back, Ducati's come back.
Harley Davidson don't race bikes, though, do
no.
they?
No.
In America, they're pretty heavy. Yeah.
Racing bikes?
Racing their bikes.
Yep.
Now you'll find this a very naive question, Mick. Now, is there a mathematical calculation or is it just off the seat of your pants, if you like, how far you can lean a bike into the corners? Because, as I say, you come down the straight at 230 miles an hour, but if any motor racing, it's about getting around the corners and through the chicane and all that. How do you know how far you can lean the bike over? They lean it over so far that their knees and elbows touch on the inside, or is that just, do you just pick that up as you go?
You do grow into it. You don't do that the first time you go riding.
No.
You're on really good bikes, you're on really good tyres. The thing that stops you sliding so much is the tyre and the suspension. If that's set up properly, you can lean over further and further, where a bike that's not set up will slip out.
But is that a modernism, the sliding going around corners now? I go back to your day, and you wouldn't have had the protective equipment, am I right? You would have worn jeans, I suppose, football socks or something along that line, and you wouldn't have – the bikes wouldn't have been as quick. Did you lean your bikes then or
– Yeah, we did. I might have worn footy socks under my leathers, but we still had to wear leathers when we raced, but – the safety equipment has come on in leaps and bounds, you know, with the introduction of Kevlar and carbon fibre. You see the guys crash and get up and walk away, where that never, you'd wait for the ambulance to come in the old days.
They have those little air balloons in their...
Oh, they've got, yes, airbags in their jackets.
Airbags in their jackets.
So they inflate if they crash.
Do they inflate automatically or do they have to pull something?
No, it happens straight away.
So when they... Well, they do like an airbag.
Yeah. Yep, it's like a cushion so they don't break their bones.
So they have a cord attached to their seat, do they? And we do that in horse. The reason I ask that is it's done in horse riding eventing. They have these vests that are attached, you know, a cord. Yep. Come off, it inflates straight away.
Yeah, it's done from within the suit.
So it inflates from within. Impact. Yes, but how does it...
Impact, it's just like an airbag. Something sets it off, some impact. So that's what keeps them pretty safe. But... you know, the speeds, I mean, they're just going faster and faster.
What about what fascinates me is their knees. Do their knees actually touch the ground when they're going through those corners, and do they wear their suits out, or what have they got in the knees to protect them?
They've got those pads. I just said
They've got to be
thick plastic pads that actually, when they lean over that far and put their knee down, it's like a stabilizer. Yes. It's a third wheel, and it's just when you're doing that, it's like you're resting on it, and you know that's as far
but
as
what's
you can
it, what's there to not wear out?
Hard plastic.
And it doesn't wear?
Oh, they're replaceable. You just held on with Velcro. So
what, through the game? Through the
probably
the race?
Wear a couple of sets out a weekend.
In a race?
In one race, they'd use one set. But
practice
and everything that they'd change.
Qualifying?
Yeah, if they wear through, then you get into your leathers, but they just replace them.
So, Mick, you said they're going faster and faster. Just what is the limit of a 1,000cc bike or a MotoGP bike? Where will it end? How can you possibly make an engine which is not battery-driven, which is, thank heavens, it's just still naturally aspirated engine, I think? What is the limit that you can make a bike go? What do you think? It's just extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, at Phillip Island, I think now they're 335 k's down the straight.
335.
Which is 200 and something. Yeah, just
it's pretty fast.
It's and extraordinary.
But what I understand is that the horsepower is the least of the problems. They've got more power than they can use. The tyres and the technology needs to be able to be developed to put it to the ground. So they've got that more speed than the riders can use. So they need to make it work better and stick. And then they can use it.
Is any of this technology used on road bikes?
A lot of it filters through. I mean, you know, it's always amused me that in any form of motorsport, they don't have ABS.
Braking system?
No. MotoGP, all the Grand Prix bikes, super bikes, they disable any ABS. It doesn't.
So it's just how hard you can grip
the rider brake. Can brake harder than the ABS can work. Whereas... Yes. For people that aren't as skilled, the ABS is a godsend because it makes them, you know, a lot safer when they pull the brakes on too hard. So, you know, the technology is on road bikes but isn't on race bikes. But a lot of the other stuff is, that, you know, the diameter of the tyres, the radial tyres, the suspension techniques, all that sort of stuff.
So, Mick, you mentioned Phillip Island. Have you ridden on courses all around the world? And have you? And... Is Phillip Island, to your knowledge, regarded as one of the great attractions, or do we overblow ourselves a bit and think we're a bit more important than we are?
I think Phillip Island's a fantastic circuit. I mean, it's
The world.
Yeah, they do. It is like for a racer, you can go to a track that's could be in Detroit in a car park, and you're racing around concrete barriers like they have at Surfers Paradise, where it's not a natural circuit.
Yep.
Bathurst is a natural circuit.
Yep.
Phillip Island is built, and it goes around a natural area. There's no
geographical.
Yeah, it's not
topography.
It's not in a housing estate or a car park or an airport. It's actually unique in the way it is. And when you ride around there, it is actually very pleasant. It's beautiful. A lot of tracks, you feel like you're in a slot and you're just looking at walls and stopping. But Phillip Island, the ocean, you go down that straight and you can't see anything but the ocean.
Yep. Unfortunately,
you wouldn't be concentrating on the ocean.
Well, you've got to watch where you're going, but it's very pleasant.
It's very well produced television wise. The way every corner or every part of that straight is covered.
I look at Albert Park and I'm amazed at how fantastic it looks from a helicopter shot when you see how narrow the land is from Albert Park across to the beach. Through Middle Park there or Albert Park. It's a little narrow strip of land. But with the city in the background, it just looks fantastic. But it's not such a great track to go around. It's not a natural circuit where
Phillip Island... It's a hybrid track.
Yeah, and Bathurst. I mean, it's like a beautiful road that's a racetrack.
So who did you... Who are some of the personalities, or who's the best rider going around today? I presume Mark Marquez, is he? Although he got banged up pretty severely a couple of weeks ago, didn't he?
Yeah. He's had a lot of lucky escapes. When he was a young guy, I remember him racing at Phillip Island in the 600s, and he crashed like four or five times in practice.
Because he just pushes the envelope?
He just goes really fast. He is...
So he's got no fear, Mick? Or he's stupid?
No, I think he's just got great skill. He's a step above the rest.
So he's the best going around.
Yep.
And Valentino Rossi probably was, but he's at the. Is that right or not?
It's like heavyweight champs. They're the best when they win the title, and they're not forever. They're not the best.
No.
Valentino's sensational. Like so many sports would love to have a Valentino Rossi.
Yep.
Because he talks to people. He's promotable.
Got a great name.
Friendly, yeah, he great name and a really good attitude.
And what would at the height of his earning, what do the top bike riders we were talking about on the last segment about sports people earning money, what is top rider promotion-wise?
100.
Million a year? It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Who's the best, Mick, ever?
Ever.
Lee Matthews, Gary Ablett. I mean, in an era, some guys are fantastic.
Who do you think's the best?
All of them. I mean, I look at Mick Doohan and what he did for a bloke that just came out of Surfers Paradise and rode a motorbike. He was fantastic, you know. Wayne Gardner for his guts. Like, they called him Digger because he just wouldn't give up. He was, like, in the trenches all the time. Casey Stoner, I remember talking to Wayne and Mick about it, and I said, "Is he? You know?" And they said, "Mate, he is just that good. The bike,
skillful.
Everyone's tried to ride that Ducati, and they can't get on with it. Casey got on it and just smoked him. I mean, he just was in a different dimension, and he was sensational. You know."
So, what are you saying? Different riders for different bikes?
And some, you know, as they develop the tyres, some guys' techniques suit that type of tyre, and it's they happen to be in the magic moment where everything lines up and they go well. But, you know, Hailwood was fantastic. I mean, there's been lots... Agostini, I mean, there's been lots of fantastic...
Agostini, yeah.
You know, you can't say, you know, who was the best full forward of all time. I mean, Plugger, I don't know.
But you can have you can have your favourite.
Agostini... I know nothing, Mick, but Agostini would have to be... He's a bit like Fangio in the Formula One, mainly because he probably was the best
when it started. 15 times world champion. He was a great rider.
Who?
15 times.
Agostini?
Yep.
Well, who's better than that?
But Mick's saying...
You're talking statistics or skill.
Are you saying that it's a bit like a coach? The best coach doesn't necessarily win the flag. It comes down to cattle. Well, in this case,
it's a bit that the best riders seem to go the best, no matter what they're riding.
Right.
So okay. Is there a difference between the best person with the best stats and the best skill? Is there a difference?
Yep.
Well, if you didn't have the skill, how would you have the best stats? The machinery.
How does a heavyweight win a world title? One punch and he's the world champion.
Not just 15 times. Punch. Not 15 times, Mick.
No, but Ago had a 10-year period where he rode 350s and 500s.
Okay.
So and he rode the only works MV Augustas. No one else had one.
We're not disputing anything you say, Mick. We're just intrigued. He was a
great rider, but he had a mechanical advantage as well.
And who from chatting to all your contemporaries, who are Valentino Rossi, a great personality, yep. Is he? Who are considered...
Valentino's great rider, but, you know, he's nearly 40 and he's still doing it, so he's great rider. Mick Doohan, fantastic. Like, there was some Americans were fantastic as well. Kevin Schwantz was a great rider.
Oh, yeah, Kevin, yeah.
But Mick, I mean... I used to ask Mick, you know, what makes him so good, and he said, well, nothing. I don't think they try hard enough. That's what he said. And he'd always amazed he'd get off the bike at the end and he'd take his helmet off and he wouldn't be sweating.
That's Schwantz you talk about.
No, I'm doing.
Yeah, right.
And the other guys that get off and they have to carry them off the bike, they're stuffed. And he'd say, they just don't train hard enough, you know. And I mean, Mick was a fanatic.
And what, off the bike as far as fitness
went? Very fit and mentally so strong. One of those guys you wouldn't never have to motivate, you'd have to wind him up. He'd figure it out and he'd be the best he could.
So is there a jealousy amongst the teams? It's a bit like Formula One. Why the Formula One other cars don't pinch all the people who've made the Mercedes the number one car and poach them and cross-pollinate? Is there a jealousy between the the bike teams do they go... get pinched and poached to try and...
They do. There's a pecking order. But the best bike attracts the best riders. It's like Hamilton in the Mercedes. I mean, it's the best car. If you're not in that, it's going to be hard to win. He's the best driver and you put them together and you're very hard to beat him. So the best riders are attracted to the best bikes.
So you're a devotee, I presume, of all motorsport, Mick. The Formula One seems to have, since they've... combined the electric cars with the they've just ruined the franchise, in my opinion.
Oh, I think that's been the way for a long time.
The ruination?
Yeah, Formula One. I mean, you said it before in the intro, Sam. Motorbike riders are doing it. They're actually doing the business. They're racing trying to win. Formula One, you know, it's making an appearance.
It's a contrived, concocted exhibition of wealth benefit to the viewing public. It's become boring, and I used to love it.
It's a giant gravy train.
And
a lot of people earn a lot of money in it, so they don't want it to stop. But I heard Valentino Rossi talk one day, and he said that they wanted to get him into Formula One because they want that sort of character and, you know, he's Italian and marketable, all that sort of stuff.
Imagine him driving a Ferrari. Are Ferrari?
He drove them. And he said there's just no passion in it. You've got to drive the car to a formula. You don't put in what you do. You can't go off the line.
So has it gone downhill since Bernie Ecclestone got out of it? No, but at least he tried to contrive the thing to make it interesting. Well, now it's just...
Well, people talk about, you know, the 50s and 60s when Jack Brabham was the man and the cars would move around and they'd drive and...
Schumacher?
Well, they started to get technology then with wings so that... you couldn't go off the line. That's why they don't pass, because they get within 100 metres and it's unstable.
That's right.
And so they've got to back off. It's just sort of counterproductive, you know. The last few MotoGPs, you'd see more action in one MotoGP than you see a season of F1, and that's the problem. You know, they talk about passing in the pits being a highlight.
They do too, Mick.
They don't race on the track. They go into the pits if they come out 3 seconds quicker.
So what would you do to make it better?
Take the wings off. Make the tyres skinnier, they've actually got to drive them. Valentino said, if you go around the corner and they say you've got to do 200 k's around the corner, if you do 180, you'll slide off the track, because unless you're doing 200, it doesn't suck it down hard enough that it grips. And he goes, well, they're telling me how to drive it. I want to be, I want to be using my passion. That's with bikes. They do. There's a million ways to pass, and they find them.
So
in cars, there isn't.
So Rod here alerted me to a video of Ayrton Senna. Lewis Hamilton was asked to drive, or was given the opportunity to drive, Ayrton Senna's Formula One car, and he said it was just extraordinary. He said because I had to change gears, and when you consider that Ayrton Senna was driving it around Monaco, whatever you call it, he said he had to only hold the wheel with one hand and change gears with the other hand. He said we just hang onto the wheel and flip the gears with the flipper gears.
There's a whole lot of things, they virtually don't have a clutch anymore.
They don't
change with a button, and the computer generates all the matching of revs and speed, so it's all smooth.
So if you consider that any sport is really there for the fans, because if you don't have the interest in the fans, people don't go and buy all the merchandise and sell the cars. Why don't they try and address it to make it competitive? What did they put the batteries into the car to show how clever they are in the coming ages of electric-powered cars? Why did they do that?
I don't know. I think it's like a battleship. It's just on a course and very hard to change. A lot of those people have got vested interests and they don't want to lose what they're making.
Now, Mick,
but isn't that what? Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Isn't that what Formula One's always been? No, and isn't that where cars are heading? They're all going to be hybrid soon and all electric. Don't they have an obligation to do that? That's where the technology filters down. Surely. And haven't we been in these? I was saying to Sam, I was arguing with him that I remember in the 80s, like you had a period where Williams were the best, where you had Nelson Piquet and Mansell winning everything, and then you had the same thing with McLaren when you had Prost and Lauda. I mean, is it that different? Is it that we have one team dominating? The problem is we just don't have two competitive drivers at Mercedes-Benz where they're going at it. Do you know what I mean? Lewis is winning everything.
Yeah, but I think part of the deal is that Lewis says, "Well, whoever there is the driver in the team isn't going to beat me."
Right.
So the first thing is we don't get a guy that I think can beat me, and the second thing is that this guy always finishes behind me. I mean,
that's number one
driver calls that.
And that's happened for the last forever.
That happened with Schumacher and Barrichello. Is that's the same thing?
Oh, there's lots where they say you can't pass him, and I mean sometimes the other guy does to prove the point, and he doesn't go too well after that.
So, Mick, you will probably anticipate that we're going to ask you this question, but we didn't get you in here, of course, to ask you this, but 2006 was an interesting year for you because you were sitting next to the great Peter Brock when he met his demise. Bit hard to know what to ask you about that, but for a start, why were you sitting next to him? Were you not a navigator? You were a co-driver or just the navigator?
I asked myself the same question. Why did he pick me? I've got no experience in navigation or whatever. I kept saying, why did he pick me?
Well, you must have a rapport or a respect.
I knew Peter for a long time. He assisted us a lot with racing bikes, sponsorship-wise and just advice-wise.
Did he ride bikes?
He wasn't a natural motorcyclist.
No.
A lot of admiration for Peter, a lot of respect. He was a human being. He had some frailties and some incredible strengths. But as a car driver, I raced a car for a little while. I sort of had an idea how it all worked from my bike racing career. But to get in the car with him was a real eye-opener. Just how precise and how it was just amazing how he could drive.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he'd correct the car before it slid. It was like a cat. He just had that ability to just balance the car and talk to you while he was doing it.
So was this in the Targa or at the Targa races or on a racetrack?
Well, I've been, on a track with him a couple of times, just sitting in the passenger seat for a hot laps. But we did Targa Tassie in March 06, and that was like a week of going all over Tassie doing different things, and that was fantastic. Then we did a hill climb up at Lake Mountain, and then we went to Western Australia for Targa West, and he'd been away doing different things in England and came back. And, it was just everything was going fantastically until we went off the track.
So you're in a Daytona sports car.
Daytona Coupe.
Daytona Coupe. Yep. And it says in the information that we look, it said that you were a co-driver. Were you ever a co-driver with him?
They call it a co-driver because, you know, you're a driver and co-driver. But basically I was a navigator. But because Peter was in England at Goodwood, yep. I drove it in the prologue, which is like a seeding lap thing. So they get some times and then they give you the starting order. But, yeah, co-driver, navigator is the same thing.
Well, you must have been pretty good to be able to drive or qualify the car.
Oh, I thought I was fantastic until I got in the car with Peter, and then I realised, you know, he was just in a different world.
So I don't know if you were aware of this at the time, but Bev, I think, his wife, partner?
Was never she? Married.
No, but that's right. He was his...
Ex-partner.
His partner.
At that time.
She said on the... After it happened, after he lost his life, she said that he was jet-lagged and had a poor attitude and should never have got in the car. Was that your understanding of it, or is that just...
Hell hath no fury as a woman scorned.
No, that was exactly why I asked you that, because would have known what his state of mind was rather than someone who's looking on from the sidelines.
Peter hadn't been with Bev for 18 months. They were separated, gone their own ways.
Yep.
He was very happy with Julie Bamford.
Yes.
He was just really happy and having a great time. I did hear some competitors discussing the fact that he was jet lagged and, you know, whatever. Peter was a great traveller.
Yep.
You know, he came back, he flew to Perth. We had dinner on the Thursday night. You know, he looked $1 million. We did the first stage on Friday morning and we were second fastest in a stage that would have suited the four-wheel drive rally cars rather than a V8 sports car. And it was wet and slippery. I mean, he was driving like he does, like Brock does. He just drove, you know, fantastically. In the second leg, we were doing the same thing and there was just one corner that was off camber, wet, whatever, slid off and hit a tree.
Just before it happened, did you have any inclination? Did you see this coming, the accident, not his death, but did it just happen instantaneously?
Well, I know that's say your convoluted question before your eyes.
Did it go in slow motion?
Yep, we were going backwards at 100 and whatever k's an hour off the road in the bush, and it was just it was over in an instant, but it seemed to take a long time. And I've never been in a plane crash, but I reckon that's what it would have been like. You know, we hit the tree, like, just as hard as, you know.
So,
like, I broke my pelvis and ribs, yep, and a whole lot of things,
yep,
and I was on the other side of the car to the tree. So the integrity of the car with the roll cage and the way it's designed, you know, the guy that made the car down in Mordialloc, I went and thanked him very much because, you know,
yep,
he did such a good job and I'm still here. But stuff just flew around in the car and windows smashed. I mean, it was just horrible.
So when you realised that you were alive, when you gathered that you were still breathing, did you realise that he wasn't? Or did he die instantly?
Yeah.
So did you realise immediately that he wasn't living?
Not straight away. I mean, I didn't assume anything. I was talking to him. I could see that he was not in a good way.
During the accident, incidentally, if you don't, I hope you don't mind us talking about this, but it's a while ago and it might be emotional to you, but just genuinely interested to know if you realised he wasn't going to make it, or realise that?
At the start, I was talking to him saying, don't worry, we'll be okay, but... You know, he was bleeding profusely, and when I actually figured out, you know, the dust settled, I could see that, you know, he was
not long with us.
He was probably gone.
And how long before the medical, how long before you received some assistance?
You wouldn't believe it. I reckon 30 seconds.
30 seconds? I thought it would be an eternity.
Pulling on the door. I mean, we were in the middle of the bush and people just came out from behind trees that were watching it. And then the fellow competitors, they start 2 minutes behind us. So when we're off the road, the guy that was right behind us, they were there within 2 minutes. And, I mean, I couldn't get out of the car because I broke and stuff, but they had to get the jaws of life and cut the roof off and lift me out the top. And, you know, I still thought I could, you know, walk to the ambulance, but it was pretty hard. But, yeah, it was just we hit the hardest tree, you know, the hardest wood tree they ever make.
What, Jarrah?
No, it was worse.
Carra.
Some tree, the mayor, some guy from Western Australia talked to us at dinner and he said, look, just be careful out there. We got the hardest trees in the world. Whatever it was one of those. It just was like steel.
Do you mind talking about it?
No, Mick? I mean, there's not a day goes by I don't think about it.
That's what I was just, you know, my next question, does it still live with you?
It does. You know, I don't dwell on it, but if somebody asks me, I'm prepared to talk about it. I think that, you know, Peter deserves it. He was a great Australian, did a lot of good things. There's questions about some things, but, you know, I'm still to get to the bottom of them. But to me, he was a fantastic guy, an exceptional car racer and a visionary. He had lots of good ideas.
He had that, speaking about that, he had that extraordinary controversy with having crystals or magnets or something that he...
Energy polarizer.
What was that about? Did he put in cars or did Holden, Tirana or Holden take the energy polarizers or whatever they're called? What was all that about?
Oh, it's just a track he went down.
Transcendent.
He had a guru that, you know, was influencing him. And, you know, I mean, for mechanical type people, stuff like that doesn't mean anything, you know. But... somebody says you rub this on your hand and it makes the pain go away and it works, you go, well, that works. But whether it makes it go away or you think it does, if it works, it works.
That's it. I've got, you've got
a polarizer on your
wrist. I've got an Eken bracelet that's got a magnet in it, and someone said this actually neutralizes the
ions.
Ions. And I said, really? And it is absolutely, what do you call that,
the placebo
effect. And I said, why do you wear it? I don't know. So someone said it's good for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Pete was, look, he was into alternate things. And that was one thing that amazed me. Like, we spent a week driving around Tasmania next to each other doing, I don't know, half a dozen to a dozen race stages a day, but the rest of the time transporting to the next stage. So we'd talk about stuff and look out the window. And you know, he was just besotted with stone walls, and we'd go past farmhouses because he had a farm up at St Andrews and he wanted to put a stone around the fence, around the gate, and he's looking at all the different options and the stone shapes and the styles. And
all your racing?
No, well, we're just transporting along. We're just shooting the breeze, you know. You know, and it just was really strange.
I remember being with him in 2005, you know, for Sandown. He was the co-driver with Scafie, and I happened to be in the pits. And whenever we walked from the pits to anywhere, it was like being with Elvis. It was just amazing. It was like a Pied Piper. People just waited and just absolutely all over him. But he was so good with all his fans. He was a superstar. Like, he was one of the untouchables in sport.
I probably like to think that I've learnt some good things from Peter. And one of them is respect for other people. You know, I remember laying in the ambulance going to the hospital at somewhere in Perth, going along, and I was just like in a state, and I'm just thinking, gee, thinking of all the things I've done with Peter, and I'd been to Japan and raced at Mount Fuji when he was racing the Commodores over there, been to Bathurst with him a few times, all around different things. We've done half a dozen Australian safaris where he was driving a car and I was involved in the motorbikes, and I've seen him like in the middle of nowhere just talk to people, the middle, you know, 500 k's out of Alice Springs, and they'd come and he'd sit there and he'd sign posters and talk to people until there was no one left. And, you know, he was always, he was critical of the younger V8 supercar guys where they go and hide in the trailers, they don't want to give back. And he said, these guys don't realise the fans are the ones that make them relevant.
He said that to me. He compared them to triathletes. He said they were just becoming robots. They were just these,
Yeah, and you know, he like even people, I remember it at Sandown, at the Sandown 500s or whatever they used to have, and some guy came along at the end of the day, and I think he'd had a few drinks, and he was giving Peter a bit of lip. Typical, you know, yobbo type thing. And Brock, within 5 minutes, the bloke's his best mate, and they're talking about cars and diff ratios, and he just had that ability to communicate with people at all levels.
So it'd be a Ford Holden thing, wouldn't he? Probably, yeah, a Ford...
The guy was a Ford guy, and you know, I mean, I was really lucky one day. I do a bit of work with the AGPC, and one day, one GP, my job was to...
What's AGP?
Australian Grand Prix Corporation. I do some promotional stuff for the Formula One and the MotoGP. And my job at F1 was to drive Brock and Moffat around for public appearances and autograph sessions, and they were doing the demos in the Tirana versus Ford promo thing. And just driving them around in a golf cart all day to different venues and meeting people, and they'd take them for autograph sessions, and people had come along, and just the emotion. Like, I remember one older guy came up with a really old magazine, and he gave it to Moffat, and he said, "Oh, could you sign this, please, Mr. Moffat?" You know, and he was older than Moffat, so he goes, and he said, "I've never liked you, but I've always admired you." And just, you know, between Peter and Moffat, they were very fierce competitors, but then there was a lot of respect as well. And they got on fantastically, you know. It was great.
I think you're underselling yourself a lot. What fascinates me, watching the European rallies, the Navigator, and obviously you were that, how much work do you do prior to the race in going around, looking, studying the course?
That's a good question, Don, but...
Well done, Don.
Some events...
taking an hour.
You're not allowed to pre-run the course. You're not allowed to know what's coming.
So what's the point?
Well, you've got notes. That's the Navigator.
Who gives you the notes?
You buy them. People make them. The people who plot the course... rally type people, they'll give you the notes, and there's a format.
Does everyone have the same?
No, there's a couple of different options, different styles, but you can choose whatever you want. You cannot run the event without notes. I mean, you can. You can close the book and Peter could just drive how he drive. But I could tell when I got the synergy of reading the notes to his speed was like music.
Like, hang on, what do you... I don't understand.
Well, you've got to tell him what's coming up. He can't
see. That's what I mean. But if you don't plot the course and go out and say, well, we've got a break here,
I look in the book
or...
and it says 100 metres turn right, 200 metres turn left, but in a code and from a 1 to 9 grading of corners.
Yeah, that's what yeah.
So a 1 is pretty well straight on, and 9 is like, you know, 180 degrees. So he knows the type of corner coming from the number.
Yeah, I understand all of that, but... you're relying on someone else to give you this information.
Well, they check it and they check it and they check it. They go through and make sure everything's right in the book.
So is that the same in the rally?
Yep.
World Rally, you WRC. Know, the Peugeots, yeah, the WRCs. That's the same. Yep, now you're not allowed to see the
can't,
track.
No, can't.
That's extraordinary. And well done, Don. No one had realised that.
Well, I always maintain, like, Brock would drive for, you know, one stage might be 10 minutes, and then we'd have an hour of transport to the next one. And in the meantime, I've got a...
Hang on. Well, you said he drove for 10 minutes.
In the event, in the rally, the there's stage. A 10-minute stage.
Right.
And then you reach the end of that stage.
Yes.
And then you go to another stage.
And there might be... you've got to travel a fair way, Don, for that stage. It's not... it doesn't continue. It's not... one stage doesn't necessarily link from the first...
We could do 10 stages in a day that could be from 3Ks to 10Ks long. Just different strips of road.
But not necessarily. Oh. They wouldn't necessarily be connected.
Oh, okay. And so, where...
So while he's driving along, he'd be sitting there looking out the window, and then I'm madly plotting where we've got to go, what time we've got to be there, how much fuel we've got. And by the end of the day, we go back to the hotel, and I was completely spent.
So so you don't do any stage more than once, so you don't build any familiarity with it?
No. Look, the guys that do the event every year would probably do... they might have... 100 stages, and then one year they'll use 70, but they keep changing them. So they're not always the same stages. And some stages they run backwards next year, so you start at the finish and go that way. But I could tell a couple of stages, Brock got the notes from somebody else, and a couple of the stages that they were last year's notes, and the stages that they ran this year that were new, we didn't have notes for. So that's why I haven't got any notes. He goes, okay, I'll just drive it. And I could tell from how he drove, when it was right, it was just so much smoother. But when he could still drive fast by himself, but not as fast.
And was he well compensated financially for his expertise in driving the Taranas? And
Yeah, he was. He enjoyed a good life.
So hang on, can I just... So you've got rally drivers, you've got... they're all different. Brock wasn't the best rally driver, but in his field he was the best. Then you got Formula One. It doesn't go across the ability, a number of different facets.
No. Like Peter was, you know, a fantastic touring car driver. Don't know if he ever transcended into Formula One or open wheelers, but other people weren't such a good touring car driver but excelled in open wheelers. So there is some sort of difference in their skill level.
Speaking of well remunerated, what's going on with Schumacher?
Haven't they given him some respect? No one has ever done any, ever tried, have they, to do the life story of him? His family and his contacts just will not allow it, won't they?
Well, I just think that, you know, it's, there's a lot of people would have made a living on that gravy train. And, you know, if Michael Schumacher passed away, that gravy train pretty well stops and a lot of people get thrown off. And I saw
I don't understand what you're talking.
Well, I saw that with Peter. That, like, I can tell you, we were staying at the Burswood Casino in Perth.
Yeah.
The accident happened on Friday. I was in hospital until Saturday. I got out of hospital, and then I think we checked out of the hotel on Monday morning. All the pre-arranged payments had been cancelled. As soon as he was passed away, everything got shut down. So they said, well, you can't leave, you've got to pay. And I said, well, you know, I said, no, it's nothing to do with that. You've got to pay because you stayed in the room. So,
wow.
And then, you know, Peter had personal assistants, he had other arrangements, and basically the wheels fell off everything. Like, they didn't have a job on Monday because he wasn't there. And that's how it worked. And, you know, mortgages and contracts and a whole lot of heavy duty stuff, you know. So with Schumacher, I imagine a much higher level of earning for the people on the train as well as him driving it. But so if he's not the driver anymore, a lot of people haven't got a job.
They hardly ever mention Schumacher on the Formula One discussions, how he's going, what his progress is. It's just as though...
I think that's the wishes, you know.
Yes, I know, but it's amazing that besides all those wishes, they never leave too many other people alone.
No. It's a lot of respect, I think. A lot of respect.
Righto.
Can I ask a layman question? I was going to buy a bike. I noticed you rode one in today. I work next door to an accountant who raced them, and he said...
Don't buy one, Don, please.
And that's exactly what he said to me. He said, I race them, but I'd never ride a bike on the road, yet you rode a bike in here today. What do people do on the road when it comes to riding bikes?
Ride very safely.
How do you do that?
Always allow for other people to do stupid things and give them plenty of room. I would have thought my experience riding a horse would have been more dangerous than riding a motorbike.
Well, that's what I tried to get to you earlier about guts and, you know, the adrenaline rush and whatever else. It's all relative to different sports and different things. That's what I was trying to press
you.
Well,
I mean, you've got to have, you know, when I say skill or talent, I mean, it's a combination of things. You've got to have guts and you've got to have... you know, a bit of go in you. But, you know, whether you ride a horse or ride a motorbike, how close do you want to go to the edge?
Now, Mick, my great philosophy is that they shouldn't have speed limits for motorbikes on the road. Just let them ride as quick as they like because they'll end up killing themselves.
Temporary Australians, is that the one?
They go past... I live on the top of a high-rise building on the freeways and they go down there at 150, 60k an hour down there. I should just let them go and do what they like. Bikes,
crazy people do. I mean, they probably do that in cars. You probably hear the motorbikes more because they make more noise. But I mean, there's plenty of crazy people doing crazy things.
Well, now, Mick, I wasn't going to make this about me. But my one of my great photos, I used to drive a Lamborghini, race it, and my great photo of all time, I have it in a prominent position at home, is me standing on the third tier of the podium at, it was called the Nations Cup. Brock won it at Albert Park.
Monaro,
Darcy Russell in a Dodge Viper, and me in a Lamborghini standing on the third step. As one of my all-time enduring photos of anyone I've been photographed with. So Mick Hone Motorcycles.
I was there and I saw that and I did speak to you because that was in your embryonic car racing
days. Yes, that's right. When you say you thought you were a good driver until you got in with Brock, I thought I was a reasonable driver until I only had a very fast car, a Lamborghini, which made me beat all the other people behind me. That was the only reason.
Anyway, as long as you have fun.
It was the most exhilarating and scary thing I've ever done. And if you want an adrenaline rush, I can understand what bikes would do to you. Don, never buy a motorbike. I've had two in my time, a Quacker 900 when I was in the 60s and then a Yamaha 650. So I've got a motorbike license, but I'm not sure. In fact, I rode your motorbike the other day. We went to the tennis in it when the tennis was going. Mick Hone.
Scary.
This has been a fascinating insight into bikes and you and the world of motorsport, and we thank you for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Don't clap, Don. That's what you're...
I'm hoping around the streets late at night. I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again. I'm just crazy about you, babe.